Hi there, debated listeners, it's Will here. Before we continue, I wanted to tell you about a podcast I'm really enjoying at the moment. We're currently facing one of the most challenging moments in human history. Our government's under increasing pressure to bring about the results people expect, while remaining trusted and relevant. And yet, the systems, structures, and processes of government today are often not set up to respond to the complex challenges we face as a society. Reimagining Government is a new podcast from the Centre for Public Impact and Apolitical that explores radical new approaches to addressing the most pressing issues of our time. By speaking with public servants and politicians at the heart of government worldwide, it shines a light on how to reimagine government so that it works for everyone. From the climate crisis to equitable healthcare provision and how to rebuild trust with marginalised communities, listen to the Reimagining Government podcast to explore today's most urgent global issues. Don't miss out. Find and follow Reimagining Government on your favourite podcast streaming platforms.
I will work day in and day out.
Wake up and smell the coffee.
I want to return to the European Union.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Charles Loft, author of Last Trains, Dr. Beeching and the Death of Rural England. Welcome to the podcast, Charles.
Thank you, Will.
Great to have you on. Now, the first question that I'd like to ask is, what prompted you to write Last Trains?
That's a good question. Well, it actually was the subject of my PhD about, 20 odd years ago. We studied at Peter Hennessy, and it's a very long time ago. And obviously the PhD was quite a sort of academic study of what the civil service had done. But I felt that I was constantly running into people who would give me a brief lecture on my own subject. When I mentioned Dr. Beeching, and if you say I work on transport policy, people sort of think, but once you mention Dr. Beeching too, it tends to be men of a certain age that they will give you a little lecture about it. And I thought it would be, you know, good to write a book that was hopefully accessible to people with an interest in railways and an interest in, you know, why their local line is closed. And I think it's, I think there are two elements that make it a fascinating story beyond people who are just interested in how policy. One is that it's a story of how local communities tried to resist government policy and how, you know, first they were quite successful, then the government changed the rules, and then and then ultimately, you know, what would happen was entirely prevented by opposition. So it's quite an interesting story there, and it's also an interesting story because in the 90s, when I first started looking at this, there were people who sort of saw it all in terms of a conspiracy by the road lobby and the oil companies to do down the railways. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't. It wasn't a conspiracy. Whatever you think of policy, it was a genuine attempt to predict and accommodate the transport needs of the future. And we look back and say, good. There's a lot of things we can learn from that. And I think it's, and I sort of come into taking an interest in politics from, a broadly radical background. It was easy to get into a mindset seeing government as being entirely a sort of conspiracy against the people, I guess. And I think it's important to understand, that isn't, you're not saying there's never anything underhand or corrupt, certainly, but it's important to understand that even people working diligently with the best of intentions end up doing things that, well, what why has it gone that way? Mm-hmm. And that actually policy making is a really complex.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things in that, in terms of policy making, is you open the book by recounting an incident in which Willie Whitelaw is accosted by a farmer who says that because of the railway cuts, he wouldn't know what time to go home for his tea, to which he was advised to buy himself
a watch. And I think that this anecdote reveals a greater truth about how the changes to the railways affected ordinary people's lives. Do you think that the scale of the impact, how much it would change people's lives, was perhaps underestimated by the government at the time?
Yes, I think, broadly speaking, yes, I do. That doesn't necessarily mean that they always got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's applicable everywhere, isn't it? That if policymakers don't represent the lived experience of the people who are affected by policy, then, you know, they tend to underestimate the effect. And, you know, if you're someone who can easily afford a car and doesn't live in, you know, Melton Constable in the middle of the North Countryside and doesn't have children who have to get 10 miles away and rely on the train, it's easy to underestimate the impact of that. And in fact, in the government made genuine efforts to try and establish what hardship was caused by a closure and to alleviate it. It was interesting that that process ultimately boiled down to saying people get to work. And it wasn't so, and maybe can they get to school? It didn't take account of, in particular, the fact that people who relied on the railway, for days out, to visit family, to do things that are vital to the quality of life, but are difficult to quantify economically. You know, if you suddenly can't get out, your life, I'm sure it's a lovely place, but your life is going to be pretty miserable. You can't visit your friends and family. I mean, the entire Great Central Main Line came to be closed. But there was one case, a woman in a place called Woodford Holt, which was an important junction on the line, but a tiny village, who relied on the railway to visit her elderly mother, Leicester, I think it was. And clearly closing the railway was going to be a disaster. She had no way of getting to visit her mother. But, you know, are you going to keep 50 miles of double track main line open so that one person can visit their mother? No, of course you're not. But exactly where you draw the line in terms of that impact on quality of life versus cost, that judgment was being made by people who were never going to suffer detriment. And so question of exactly how you take it. Well, I mean, I think that's something that affects policymakers. You know, it's an ongoing constant, isn't it? How do you ensure that the people taking decisions really appreciate what those decisions mean to people who may have very different lives from them?
Given that in the report, in the Beating report, there is a suggestion that more than double the amount of line closures that were actually implemented were closed, do you think that had his recommendations been carried out in full, the rail industry would be in a much different state than it is today? And do you think it would be in a better place or a worse place if all of the Beeching Report's recommendations had been carried out?
As far as the rail industry is concerned, I'm not sure. I mean, it would be much smaller. He carried out studies that would have left us with 5,000 miles of less than 5,000 miles of passenger railway, which is, roughly speaking, would be half the size of it is today. There'd probably be maybe a line to Aberdeen, nothing much. Glasgow and Edinburgh, for example. It would be a much smaller industry. I don't think it would actually be very different today because there was no size to which you could really reduce the railway that would make it operate without a subsidy.
Yeah.
And that's okay because people benefit from the existence of railway services who don't pay to use them. So there's always a case for a subsidy. The precise level is a matter of political judgment. I don't think it would make a huge difference to the industry because those bits of the railway that are still open because they're politically possible to clone, don't make a huge difference to the industry anyway. Broadly speaking, make an enormous difference to the people who use them. But I don't think the issues, for example, would still be pretty much the same, which is, what's the railway for? How much are we prepared to pay to do that? I guess you could say that one problem emphasis on closures as a route to profitability or route to losses was that far too little attention to investment. So in the mid-1970s, there were huge controls about whether the railways should back further. Whereas cutting £100 million off the railway investment budget wasn't controversial. And so the consequence of that is that, you know, we haven't electrified lines, which obviously should have been electrified years ago, as governments tended to cut investment where they couldn't make savings from closures, which was a bit of a false choice, but everybody's attention was on the size of the network rather than, you know, I would argue, and I think the logical case for this, that question of should we have electrified the main line through Leicester, Sheffield, that's actually going to affect a lot more people than if we close the line from Bridge to Sheringham, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. To what extent do you think that because of his close association with the report and the cuts that were made, that Beeching's name has become a byword for interfering bureaucracy that causes more problems than it solves? And do you think that image that is often summed up related to him is a fair assessment of him or his approach to dealing with the rail industry?
I think for a long time, Beeching's name was exactly that, a sort of byword for thankless bureaucracy that it bids. I think possibly as the people who were around at the time sort of, you know, die off, if I it's perhaps, you know, I'm not sure how long his name will continue to resonate quite so thoroughly, but it certainly was. I mean, the fact that the BBC could use his name in the title of a sitcom 30 years later pretty incredible. I mean, you'd struggle, I think, to name anybody else who was the leader of a nationalised industry. Around then, maybe, I think it was McGregor was the chair of the coal board during the miners' strike. People might remember him, but that's about it, isn't it? So, absolutely, he sort of became a mythical figure, the Axeman. And I do think I mean, it's inevitable, but it's unfair in as much as in two ways, really. First of all, Beeching was given a very clear remit, which was to say, what should the railways do? Eliminate the politicians to decide whether or not they should go ahead and do that. I mean, Beeching didn't close any railway lines. He simply identified the ones that close if the railway's primary objective was losing money. And so keeping them or getting rid of them, it's a political decision, and it's, you know, if you don't like those decisions, blame the politician. I also think that it was unduly negative that the association with Beeching, because Beeching report was the outcome of a genuine attempt to get to grips with what are the future trends and how do we provide them. And it's worth bearing in mind that part of the reason why the Beeching cuts went as far as they did was because that nettle hadn't been grasped for a very long time. I mean, before the Second World War, clear to people who were paying attention to the railways, rural branch lines, trains that stopped at every station in country areas, whether they were passenger or freight, there was no need for those trains. yes, there were some exceptions, but you know, if you've got a bus, that's going to be better for rural traffic. Central villages, it's much, much cheaper, much better. You've got merchandise freight traffic that needs to be taken to a shop or from a small factory to a shop. Probably going to, if once you've got to put it on a lorry, you might as well take it where it's going on the lorry. And yet nothing was done really for 10 years after the war to deal with the consequences. They will, and there were attempts to say, we really ought to close down a lot of branch lines and transfer the traffic bus at a nationalized transport mission that was supposed to be, you know, looking at the most efficient way of doing things. That was the most obvious thing to do, was close branch lines, replace them with buses, to build up a road freight fleet with the new sort of industries that, you know, the railways are great if you want to take coal to a power station, minerals, that sort of thing, and bulk long distance traffic. They're not so good if you want to take it to a provision factory. So the trends were in favor of road transport. Of course, people weren't thinking. So, in a way, the Beijing report was a good thing because the outcome of people sitting down and saying, right, where are we going and how, what's the best way to get there? And one of the interesting things, I think, is to compare this with today. So, Beijing was looking at 1984, and if transport trends had stopped in 1984, if you ignore carbon emissions and what we know now, then actually, you know, not just Beijing, but the accompanying report about roads, the Buchanan report, traffic out, kind of made sense. You know, we'll build more roads, everybody wants cars, we'll provide for that, and you know, railways do long distance commutes. It kind of makes sense. And the problem was obviously climate change. Also, traffic didn't stop growing in 1984. The more it grew, you could never, in particular, never accommodate it. So if we transfer that to now, and I'm not about to get into what we should be doing, but obviously things we might want to think about in terms of planning the future transport needs of the country are, and what does the pandemic mean for commuting? You know, in 10 years' time, will we still be working in the way we were 10 years ago, or will we all be working from home? That's pretty big. You know, it took a lot of money on the Elizabeth line. Let's talk about cross-country. Does it make sense if we're not going to be commuting? But it's certainly a question to think about. And then there's the question of, well, what does climate change mean for freight transport? Do we want to keep moving by road, or is there more of a role for rail? And, you know, what about long distance stuff? Do we want a high speed rail network, which we're in the process of building, or is demand going to be quite low for that? Now, I have no idea what the answer to those questions are, but I think just by posing, it's pretty clear that, yeah, if we ask those questions, then built a transport system on the basis of what we think the answers are, wouldn't be entirely surprising if people in 30 years turned around and said, God, well, you've got all that wrong. It's really hard to predict. And obviously, at the time, Beijing and policymakers in Beijing, you know, were trying to predict the future. They did a really good job, I think, of predicting what the demands would be in 20 years' time. But, what they didn't foresee was that we would then need to take account of the need to save the planet and the fact that you cannot ultimately accommodate constant growth in road.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that is interesting, both from the book and from the discussion, is the way in which road travel has been interpreted by different politicians and the expansion of it versus public transport. Do you think that this is always going to be a somewhat contentious issue going you know, back to the time of the Beeching Forward and towards today, this seeming either or approach that some people have to either focusing on, you know, people owning individual cars, and maybe it's better to change the type of car that people own from a diesel or a petrol car to an electric car, and it's better to focus on that. Or the alternative argument that some people make, it's better to invest more in public transport, in trains, in buses, that kind of thing, and just take cars off the road, regardless of what kind of technology they use to go. Do you think that that's going to be a continual argument that we're going to see go on and on and on, this road versus train or other forms of public transport argument, and that it's one that you can see really stemming from the time of Beeching and a little bit beforehand?
Yes, I mean, I think I hope that we can get away from a sort of polarized, you know, stopping motorists or being on the side of motorists argument. Ultimately, there is no getting away from the fact that we're going to have, you know, we need to make some pretty radical changes in the next few years, or we're going to destroy the planet. That's, you know, that's, and at the same time, focusing on individual motorists as how to blame for that, it's ridiculous. Because, you know, people are driving because they don't care. Others are driving because, you know, there isn't any other way they can. You know, our world is, well, at least in the West, our world is designed around the assumption of access to a car. So we need to collectively address what is the change we want to see and how are we going to get. And that's not going to happen. Boils down to a, you know, polarized, bitter brow. I think it needs to be more sophisticated than that. And I think it does. You know, in the 1950s, when the Treasury first started waking up the need to consider future transport of nature, they did rather tend to look at what's the total demand. You know, how can we divide this between road and rail, which is, I mean, it's better than not thinking about it at all, which is what they were doing before. But it's not the most sophisticated, is it? So I think, you know, it's a debate that needs to continue, but I think it's a debate that needs to be more sophisticated than just pro and anti road. You know, for I guess people who were around in the 50s and 60s, you know, the motor car was a fantastic symbol of individual freedom. I didn't drive until I was 40. When I learned to drive, got a car, there were definitely loads of things I could do that I couldn't have done. And that's very attractive. And of course, it's also not great, you know, from an environmental point of view. How do we, I guess, if the policy objective is to reduce traffic, and I think that's probably at some point, it's the point where you have to do that, even if everybody can have a car that is carbon neutral. Even if you get to that point, you've got a position where not everybody can drive into the centre of London or wherever at once. So you've got to do something else, haven't you? And I think we do need to be thinking about what. It comes down to the same questions that they were asking in 1960. You know, what is the transport system there for? How much we can pay to achieve what we need? So, which is why I sort of mentioned how we work is a pretty bit of that. For the sake of argument, if everybody who could worked at home, obviously transform what we need our public transport system and what we need our motor transport system to do. I'm not suggesting that the government should then force everybody to work. But I'm just saying, you know, the answer to the sort of, well, how do we want to work in the future? That's a key question. Until we've answered that, can't really say, well, what sort of community? And I was at a really interesting seminar a few years ago where there was a guy talking about how in the future he felt that as driving cars and possibly nobody would own them because better you just ring up a taxi when you need a car. It would turn up, you'd get in it, it would take you where you go. Then it would go off and do another job. And you wouldn't, parking wouldn't be an issue. It wouldn't need to park. AI cars driving around, roaring. And it sounded like a really good system. But what I couldn't work out was how would you get to that system? Because people like to have their own car. So are you going to price them out of the market? Are you going to fund them? Are you going to just win them over with the need to do something different? And I have no idea what the answer to that is, by the way. But I think the debate about what do we want from not just private, and what are the costs involved and what are we prepared to pay, needs to be much more dispassionate, much less passionate, rouse about parking, fuel duty. And it's difficult to see how policymakers kind of get it out of that, because those issues are so, or can be, contentious. Sorry, at the end of that comment isn't an answer.
No. But I mean, it's still a very interesting point of view, particularly in light of my next question, which is in the book, you mentioned that there's often a nostalgia associated around rail transport, and it was both at the time and something that you see as well today. Do you think that nostalgia has, in some instances, been at the detriment to the rail industry, because it's kind of forced in so many people's minds the railways into this kind of amber holding cell, that they're stuck in this vision of the sort of the old steam-powered locomotives, and so they automatically think of rail transport as something that's a bit old-fashioned and not necessarily something that they should be using or is for them.
Yes, I think there are a number of elements to it, and certainly in the book I tried to make a point that one of the reasons I think Dr. Beeching became so infamous was that people have in England particularly, people have a vision of, you know, what do you think of when you think of England? And people tend to think of a sort of, you know, village that you see in films. Helena Bonham Carter is probably there, and Rowan Atkinson's the vicar, something like that. And a steam train is a key part of that. And one of the reasons that I think we think of that is partly because there's, you know, it is quite an attractive vision in a lot of ways. But because when we see films about England, that's what we see. That's where they tend to be set. And filmmakers will almost always use a steam train when they can, because it looks great. So it sort of feeds itself. So Dr. Beeching is seen as, you know, the man who stabbed rural England in the back, if you like, and facilitated the replacement of the traditional English village with the mini market at the roundabout, and all the things that we maybe don't like about how the English countryside has changed in the last 50 years. And this was something, you know, right from the very start, the steam branch line was seen at, I'd say, the start of the closure process. By the end of the Second World War, the steam branch line was seen as something integral to the countryside. And there's a film from 1952, I think it is, the Ditville Thunderbolt, about a village that saves its railway from the soulless ministry and to close it. And the squire makes this great speech about, if you open our village up to lorries and buses, what will it be like in 10 years' time? All the houses will have numbers instead of names. There'll be traffic lights and zebra crossings. And he sort of paints a picture of a toxic modernity that is invading his traditional village. Of course, he's got a car. He's the only person in the village who's actually got a car. So right from the start, and I mean, John Betjeman's poetry was very tied up in the ideas of the railways as being fundamental to the British countryside. It was completely different from when they were built, and people didn't want railways going through the countryside because they thought they spoiled the view. So, so I think there is definitely a cultural element that the English sort of seem both the real England as being essentially rural, village-based, and steam trains are part of that. And also that the English tend to see life as being, you know, that England has declined. The whole academic literature, the idea certainly in the late 20th century, that the English tended to think England had declined, despite the fact that standards of living had risen, and you know, there were the sort of empirical measures showed that people were better off than they had been. Yet there was a feeling that modern England was somehow inferior to old England, and that Beeching was part of it. In the same way that, you know, people turn to modern state being, you know, bad thing when they were built. They were huge improvements on the stumps they replaced. So, you know, it sort of got tied up in that whole declinist feeling. I think it's a little bit different that in Scotland, where the whole debate about Scottish rail tied up with of Scottish feeling that London is dictating to Scotland that we should close. Pretty much true. The Scottish region was notorious for not closing railways, but you know, for the fairly obvious reason that in Scotland you had really long railway lines that were never going to stop losing money. But you know, if you closed the railway line from Inverness to Wicklow, I mean, that you need that railway line. Particularly the years ago, if you needed that railway line, you really needed that railway line. So the whole debate is very different. We're talking about, you know, there were several lines which were really, really long, lots of money, and it wasn't feasible to really.
Absolutely. We're coming towards the end of the podcast, Charles. Thank you for taking the time to speak to me, but I have one final question to you. For anybody who has either read the book or is going to read the book, what one thing would you most like them to take away from reading it, whether it's a particular fact or an overall impression about the Beeching Report and the changes to the railways during that period?
Oh, I think absolutely the overwhelming thing I would want them to take away from it is that when I started as a young student studying this, oh dear, it's depressing to say, over 30 years ago, I came to it having read a book called The Railway Conspiracy, which sort of painted this all as a deliberate attempt to sabotage the railways in order to boost. And what I got out of my initial research was a better understanding how policy is made, and you know, the lobbying of ruthless corporations is part of that, certainly. But I think that the whole closure controversy throughout the 50s was a fight between people trying to save local services and people who were genuinely trying to, you know, make the country work. And the nature of that debate was generally counterproductive. The objectives to early closures could make the government and the railways look bad, but they couldn't change their opinion. And so ultimately they lost. But people trying to run it from a national point of view maybe lacked the worm's eye view that they needed to have to understand exactly what the point of what they were doing was. So I think what I hope people will take is that it would be great if contentious policy could be frankly discussed, transparently made, and better understood, which I guess is motherhood and apple pie, but it seems to be a long way away by political debate works.
Absolutely. Well, thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Charles. If people want to buy a copy of the book or find out more about you, where should they go to get a copy of the book or to find out more about you?
The book is called Last Train, Stop the Beating and the Death of Rural England, and it's published by Bitebat, so it is available in all good bookshops. I would encourage you to go to a bookshop, buy it, because that way they will pay tax and you'll be supporting a vital local service, but you can get it on that other mass website. By all means, there's a Facebook page, Dr. Beat, Lost Train and the Death of Rural England. By all means.
Fantastic. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Will.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.